Hi there, I'm Rory O'Connor, Professor of Health Psychology and a Mental Health Researcher at the University of Glasgow.
And I'm Craig, a filmmaker and content creator at MQ Mental Health Research.
And welcome to MQ Open Mind, a podcast that brings together lived experience with scientific research to help us to better understand mental health problems. And we hope to do so in a way that is accessible to all.
In this episode, we speak to Regius Professor of Psychiatry at King's College London, Professor Sir Simon Resley. Simon is a psychiatrist and epidemiologist with a focus on military health and unexplained symptoms and syndromes. In 2017, the then Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, Theresa May, commissioned Simon to chair the review of the Mental Health Act based on his extensive knowledge and experience. In this conversation, we discuss Simon's unique insight into the NHS, the process of reviewing mental health legislation, and his research on Gulf War veterans.
Welcome to the latest episode of MQ's Open Mind. This week, Craig and I have another fantastic guest. We've got Professor Sir Simon Resley, and Simon is Regius Professor of Psychiatry at King's College in London. So Simon, huge welcome. Thanks a million for coming on the podcast.
My pleasure. Good to see you both.
Hi, Simon. Welcome in.
Yeah. So, Simon, I know quite a bit about you. Obviously, I've known you on and off over a number of years. And so I'm just really fascinated about your journey in sort of mental health science, so to speak. And I know, obviously, you're born in Sheffield. Mm-hmm. So maybe just take us on a bit of a journey, because we're always trying to start the podcast with trying to situate our guest into their sort of life history, so to speak.
Yeah, I mean, fair enough. I mean, I come from an arts background, if anything, not a science background. My mother was a musician and my father was a language teacher. And I was much better on the kind of arts humanities side at school. And then for reasons that I still can't remember, when I was 15, I suddenly said I'd like to be a doctor. And I don't know why. There were no doctors in the family at all. And my parents were slightly, you know, I wouldn't say appalled, but a bit surprised. But so I pursued that, got into medical school. And then I was the one person in the year who didn't do integrated science degree. I did history of art. You could probably have guessed at that point that I might end up in psychiatry, but I hadn't guessed that. But, you know, an observer of the scene might have said that. And it was because it was very well taught. I found it very interesting. And as I went through kind of the early stages of medical career, doing MRCP and things like that, it wasn't that I was bored, because I wasn't, and I had a great time. But I found the kind of things that I was still reading were still kind of psychiatry books and things like that. Mm-hmm. And then someone said, well, listen, you might as well bite the bullet and go to the Maudsley, which I did, got in. And I had no interest in research at all. So I basically lied to the dean, who was a fellow called Robin Murray, you've probably heard of.
Yeah.
And But then, you know, once you were there, you couldn't help, you know, the peer pressure was intense and the pressure from the consultants was intense. So I finally, you know, had to start doing some research, and then I just got the bug. And mm-hmm. then the big turning point was getting a welcome training fellowship in epidemiology, because if I hadn't got that, then it would have all come to nothing. But I did get that, and then everything fell into place and I knew what I wanted to do. And been doing it pretty much ever since, with some breaks to do other things. Mm-hmm. But I still enjoy it and get the buzz after all those years. But it was a decision going to psychiatry and then getting the welcome fellowship. And without mm-hmm. the welcome, nothing would have happened.
And what was that? That was the 1980s, was it?
Oh, God, yes. Yes, it was. Long time ago. Yeah, I think I got the fellowship in 88, I think, okay. Something like that.
Reflecting then on, because you've obviously ever since that time been involved in some shape or form on mental health research. Mm. So this is maybe a wee bit unfair of a question, but I mean, reflecting back now, do you think it's, because obviously psychiatry is a profession, as an outsider looking in, not as a non-psychiatrist, it looks like the profession's flourishing as an outsider looking in. Now, my sense of in the 80s and early 90s, perhaps, that was less the case. Is that true?
I think that's true. I mean, remember, I was lucky that the Maudsley was about the only place in UK which was competitive to get in. I think maybe Edinburgh, Oxford were as well. But certainly, we were the place, in the same way in those days, Great Ormond Street for peds and Brompton for cardio and the Marston for cancer, all of them London. And all of them were regarded as the kind of first among equals. Mm-hmm. So it seemed pretty healthy there. The people, you know, you were working for were some of the giants of the stage and very interesting people, even if sometimes very difficult. Mm-hmm. So it didn't feel that. But as soon as you started to get around a bit more and you realize that, yes, that, and as I got into postgraduate training and running a huge scheme, the multi-scheme, you realize that it was really was a difficult mm-hmm. profession. And was failing in recruitment. We couldn't fill our posts. And because we couldn't fill our posts, we couldn't make bids for more posts because, you know, the powers that be say, well, you know, when you filled your posts you've got, we might talk about more, but until then, you know, you can piss off. and in fact, the reason why I kind of didn't say take a career break, but that I did end up becoming president of the Royal College was solely and completely on the issue of recruitment. That if we couldn't stop and then reverse the decline in numbers, the profession wasn't going anywhere. And over a course of really 10 years and probably four presidents, we did do that. And of course, there were lots of other things as well. There were changes in society, changes in the people going to medical school and all sorts of things. But nevertheless, we did play our part. But you're right. And it was certainly unfashionable. Mm-hmm. And when I said, you know, I think I want to be a psychiatrist. When I got offered a PhD in liver studies at Newcastle, where I was working, and people did kind of, you know, take mm-hmm. a step back, and then they would either laugh or they would say something like, you know, oh, well, you're too good for that, which actually is a veiled insult. And then and all that stuff, and we had the whole lot, you know. And I was one of my early jobs was at Queen Square, the National Hospital of Neurology, which had just changed its name from nervous diseases because it was too psychiatric. Yeah. Then they went to neurology, and they would come up to you and all these hundreds of neurologists and say, "Well, you seem like a decent enough chap," because that's how they speak. You seem like a decent enough chap. I can't understand why you'd want to do psychiatry. None of your patients ever get better. And then you're thinking, this is a neurology hospital where virtually nobody got better. So there are all these prejudices that, you know, you have to embrace, really. And I think many of them still exist, if I'm being honest with you, not in society, but some of the people still with some of the more antediluvian views are our fellow professionals in medicine and professions allied to medicine. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, but in terms of just going back to the reversing the decline in numbers, so yeah, you mentioned changes in society and maybe the people who went to do psychiatry, but so what are there specific things you did as a college to arrest that or turn that around?
Yes, I think there were. I mean, I think the first thing was that we had no communications unit at all. We had an answer phone. Basically, we had one press officer and an answer phone to deal with media, which meant that lots of other organizations were always doing the media we should have been doing mm-hmm. about mental health, mental illness, things like that. And I thought, well, this is ridiculous. We should be talking on these issues. So we made a huge investment and went from 1 to 25 people in the comms unit. And we saw, I think it was a 500% increase in our media reach, Hansard numbers, all the various metrics that you have, which was pretty much about to happen if you put that investment in, but we did. Yeah. And the second thing was we didn't want to send a message of how rubbish everything is and how nobody likes us. And because, you know, you can't, you know, if you go around saying that, no one's going to want to do the job.
It's not really inspirational, is it?
No, it's not. No. And telling stories, which we were good at. Also campaigning, which we got good at. And by this time got much, much better relations with organizations such as Mind. Mm-hmm. And there was a kind of collective group of the kind of main forces in mental health with Mind, with us, Centre for Mental Health, like that, came together. And when we all kind of played as a pack, we were quite a powerful lobby, actually. Mm-hmm. But it was more and more just, you know, projecting how interesting this was, how it didn't suit everybody. You know, they're like people who like running at work should do A&E or cardiology or things like that. But we're more, you know, we take our time, patience, both being patient and having patience mm-hmm. and getting to actually know people rather better. And the one word I would never use is holistic because I hate it. But actually that is what we were promoting was, and we sometimes would say, look, we're like medicine plus. You know, we have all the best bits. We also do other things as well. And of course, pushing the research agenda was important, that we're going places, there's more to be done. But I think it was most was that, you know, we wanted people either who were intellectually inspired by neuroscience, and because this is where the next Nobel Prize is going to come from. Unfortunately, it hasn't yet, but I still think it will. Or who actually do like to spend time and get to know people, to understand families, to understand society. Mm-hmm. So it was those two twin recruitment things we did. Yeah. Got money from Sainsbury's to revolutionize, change the curriculum, make it more neuroscience. And but the whole thing was just pushing a more positive image. And at the same time, I have to say, you know, things like, you know, the bonkers Bruno's headline and things like that really played into that landscape and saying, look, that's unacceptable. Mm-hmm. And I
for
used
those who don't know, that was a headline on the Sun newspaper, I think,
that's
in the 90s.
Yes. Yeah.
About Frank Bruno, the ex-boxer.
And so there was work the Samaritans were doing on suicide reporting, but just the general thing about being more respectful towards mental disorders. And that did change. I was lucky, I'd been a journalist. I used to write columns for the Times. And I also discovered I had quite a penchant for live radio. And I really enjoyed that. And too many doctors get really, you know, intimidated by media and say, oh, well, you can't do that. You can't do that. Actually, it's great fun. And so I did quite a lot of that and enjoyed it a lot. So it was a whole sequence of things. And the other thing to be clear is that my successors very much carried this along, and we had a coherent policy of how we were going to do it right through till when we finally, you know, became competitive across the country, which was 3 years ago, I think.
Right, okay.
I think we're now more popular than surgery, actually. Yeah. And at the same time, you know, the same thing was happening in clinical psychology, was becoming incredibly popular.
Yeah.
And I just said, you know, all those, when you talk to schools, people, I want to be a psychologist, said, well, why don't you do psychiatry? You'll find it's a lot easier, and you'll know whether you've made it a lot quicker. Yeah.
But that's interesting to say, Simon. So, I mean, that, because really, that a lot of those changes are so recent, and that's a bit which is,
yeah,
you reflect on it as, I mean, as a profession, obviously we're not that, or medical or mental health science, we're what, 100-odd years old, broadly speaking, depending on how you define it.
Yeah, that's true.
And then, but these changes are really recent. But just one, two things I wanted to say came to my head when you're speaking. One is just a shout out, if you haven't heard Simon's Desert Island Discs from 2021, it's a good listen. It's a good listen.
Thank you.
No, but you do.
That was terrifying.
Well, I can imagine. it was great, actually. Because again, the story, I mean, of your life, I think it's really fascinating to hear. And then the other bit, this more serious bit is just go back to the point you made a second ago on you don't like the word holistic.
Mm.
So what's your objection to a holistic?
Oh, because holistic, certainly when it first appeared, was just a euphemism for alternative medicine.
Yeah, okay.
Basically, that was why. And as soon as someone said holistic, they almost immediately went to homeopathy or something like that. And it was just a code. Holistic in the correct term is absolutely fine. And it's a bit like biopsychosocial, which is coming under pressure. You know, it's actually fine, but it becomes a cliche.
Yeah.
And so it was that whole person, I suppose, is a bit better, but you know, the holistic, I just annoyed me because it was invariably used in Harley Street by alternative practitioners.
Whereas, of course, what we really mean by it is recognizing the links between mind and body, obviously.
Yes, and society as well.
Yeah, of course. Okay, so Simon, that sort of gives us sort of a sense of who you or where you came from and who you are type thing. So what we're hoping to cover in this conversation is touch on some of your, because I think where I first came across your work was the Gulf War work.
Oh, yeah.
And how then that led to the military medicine and the focus on that. Mm. So we're looking to cover on that. Stuff on then maybe a bit on some of the COVID work you were involved in, maybe just in passing. Something then, I suppose it'd be great to hear your views on, you obviously led the Mental Health Act reform. It'd be great to hear about that. And then more recently, I know you're recently, was it last year, became a board member of the NHS.
Oh my God, yes. Yes.
So those are sort of four we're going to try and weave in, and then maybe a bit towards
how long
the
have
end.
We got here? Or
yeah, exactly. So let's fire ahead very quickly.
Yeah.
So Tim, tell me a bit then about the Gulf War work, because that, I mean, really was groundbreaking at the time and not without controversy.
Yes. I mean, what had, by this time, what had happened with two things. One was that clinically, I was doing liaison psychiatry, and we were getting interested in seeing and starting research with your friends Tony Pelosi and Tony David into chronic fatigue syndrome. It wasn't called that then, post-viral fatigue. But so I was doing that, and that was actually my first professional paper. And then along comes something that was both different and similar. So the stories of service personnel with unexplained syndromes and symptoms that looked astonishingly similar to chronic fatigue syndrome, but from a very, very different occupational and social class background. Mm-hmm. So that was interesting, but I hadn't never met any, but you're just reading about them and seeing them on the news. And the second thing was, remember that I'd qualified now in epidemiology. I'd done my master's and my doctorate in that, and then been approached by two senior army medics who said the basic message was, we're just making a bit of a balls up of this. They knew that one of them was in public health, and they knew that they needed an epidemiological public health approach, but they didn't have the capability to do it. And so they said, would you consider, you know, getting interested and putting in to do some work for us? And we tried it with a government minister who told me, I've never forgotten, and said no, he wouldn't fund any research because he said, in my experience, research always makes things worse. I've never forgotten that. I thought that might be my motto, you know, anyway. So actually, we had to go over to the Americans and get money from the Americans to kickstart what was needed, which was a big population-based study of those who had sent to the Gulf and those in the military who hadn't gone to the Gulf.
Yeah.
It was a bit more complicated than that, but that's basically it. And off we went, and it was good. I enjoyed it a lot. You really have to learn another language. You have to learn a completely different kind of culture. You have to be sympathetic to that culture. And the fact that I actually had a pretty good knowledge of military history ever since I was a kid, I've just voraciously read history books, and a respect for tradition and culture, because that's very important with them, but not one of them. Very important, I'm not one of them, mm-hmm. and vice versa. And then the work started to go well because it really was needed. We started to make some sense of things. We showed that they were ill. We showed that they were more ill than they should have been. Something to do with the Gulf was the issue. And that meant they would then get war pensions. So it was slightly controversial, but not very, because mm-hmm. the main thing was the vast majority of the service personnel appreciated the fact now they could actually, all they had to show was they weren't well and they'd served in the Gulf. They got their pensions. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. What it was much more complicated, and to this day it remains pretty much unresolved. But the work was great, got you know, good impact, as we say these days. So the university liked it, did a lot of media, I liked it, and also got into, it takes a long time to build up trust with them. So the result was, come 2003 and the preparations for the war in Iraq, this time, some of the people I now met and got to know were getting more senior, and they realized from the start they couldn't repeat the mistakes of 10 years ago. And we were commissioned to do what should have been done 10 years ago, the big study of all we're going to send all those to Iraq and good control group, early on, not mm-hmm. wait to be dragged into it by the Daily Mirror and the Daily Mail kicking and screaming. And so we then did the repeat study as we'd done before, but bigger. And also we knew how to do it much better. And that's still going on now. I mean, it's just how many years, 25 years, we're doing a 25-year follow-up.
Wow.
And that's been a source of tremendous satisfaction, and it's mm-hmm. branched out into all sorts of different areas. And once you've got a good cohort study, Rory, as you know, you're made.
Yeah. But in terms of the unanswered questions, though, because we're a research podcast, so I'm keen to see what don't we know that you wish we did know?
Well, I think what we don't know, we won't know, was because the first I'd heard about the war was in 1991. Mm-hmm. The first, it'd been in the press, but the first time you know, I'd met anyone and spoken about to them was in 1994. Already 3 years had passed, and we didn't start the research until 95, 6. And the there were no records. The records keeping was awful. Wasn't electronic in those days. So the first thing I would have said is, for God's sake, keep records. Don't get rid of records, which they did. And that led to all sorts of conspiracy theories. And I think that there will be this gap in knowledge that won't be filled. I mean, we eliminated a lot of possibilities, but we were left with a smaller number, which will never be sorted out now. And the other thing was how research was so important was that we were able the next time to kind of show very early on what wasn't happening. There wasn't an increase in cancer. That the vaccines in the end, although a lot of suspicion was on them for good reasons, in the end, because we gave the same vaccines in Iraq, were safe, you know, short-term side effects, but didn't create long-term illness. And other kind of potential villains we were able to eliminate. And so it was then the main focus ended up being on mental health, the psychological and emotional cost to people, families, et cetera, because the other issues had either not arisen or we had the requisite data to say, look, this isn't what's happening. And there was no repeat of Gulf War syndrome. There was no Iraq War syndrome. And to this day, that's, you know, fascinating.
Yeah, absolutely.
Although when we tell the military this, I remember General Sir Mike Jackson, who was a very famous figure then, I said, we showed him the data, said, so it's history has not repeated itself. There isn't an Iraq War syndrome. He said, excellent. So we did our job. Well done, chaps. Stood up and left. And I was about to say, isn't that interesting? Wouldn't you like to know why? Yeah. It'd gone. Yeah, they're not curious about those things. He just wanted to make sure that it hadn't happened on his watch.
And you've given them the right answer.
We've given him the right answer, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
And they're great for things like that, because when you find, so we found, for example, that the reserves were getting more mental health problems than the regulars, we told them this is what we'd found. We had it accepted in The Lancet, so we gave them a copy in advance, because everybody, politicians, everybody hates being sandbagged on the day.
Yeah.
So he said, look, this is the paper. It's coming out in 6 weeks' time. And they said, okay. And then, so we then had, you know, did all the morning press conferences, which I have to say I like. Mm-hmm. And then, I can't remember who the Secretary of State was. Anyway, one of them stood up in the afternoon, welcomed new research from King's College and announced, and we're going to open a new program of mental health support for reservists. And, you know, you don't get that response in the NHS. I mean, you've never had that in your career. You've published a paper in the morning and in the afternoon they say, right, sorted. This is what we're going to do, gentlemen. It always was gentlemen, by the way.
My God, if everything was as easy as that.
I know. Yeah. But then when they don't want to do something, nothing will persuade them to do it.
Yeah. So then, Simon, that led sort of the I know that work you're saying is ongoing in the 25 years.
Yes, yeah.
But so that sort of, am I understanding you had that Gulf War research group, and then that's morphed into the military health at the Military Mental Health Research Centre?
Well, it's called the King's Centre for Military Health Research. And so by this time, I'd made strong links. Psychiatry is very good at King's, you know, it's one of the strengths of the place, and it's internationally competitive, et cetera. The other kind of jewel in the crown is what the vice chancellors always say, but is war studies. Mm-hmm. And I went and did a couple of terms there in reward for doing one of the early refs. I was given 2 terms off to go and do the MA in war studies. And made strong contacts there. And that gave us another unique selling point, that we were linked academically with one of the world's big powerhouses in research into the military, armed forces and things. So that gave us a bit of a competitive edge over other places. And also, I really liked it. I fitted in well. And so that was important. And when we set the King Center up, my co-director was a very famous military sociologist. And we had also the support of Laurie Friedman, who's the kind of god of strategic studies, and who was very, very supportive and very helpful. And that meant also, because all the senior officers from the armed forces and indeed around the world go through King's, it gave you a very good address book when you needed it. And because people knew you, they were more likely, again, you know, trust is so important in that world. They're very suspicious of outsiders.
Mm-hmm. And so that, so that's obviously going strong now.
Yes,
and
yeah.
And
was very, you know, it was very enjoyable. There's no other way. But I was allowed to go out to Iraq and Afghanistan. You know, it sounds much more dangerous than it was, but I was still able to go there because if you're studying, you know, and interested in what people do for a living, you really want to see them as close as you can to them doing the job, which you don't see back home. So that was privilege and weird.
But I think what's remarkable about it is, I mean, how you get in the science and the practice, and that sort of a real field in the field, genuinely in the field.
I think that's right. And I think also because I'm a bit of a voyeur, and you know, in other aspects of things, I've done other things, you know, beyond the normal boundaries of medicine, psychiatry. I do love watching people at work, be it journalists, like going to a drug conference. And then I ended up on something called the Judicial Appointments Commission. So for the last 6 years, I've been appointing judges, which is watching them at work. And you know, all of these things, I think it's one of the early attractions of psychiatry was this intense curiosity about people. Mm-hmm. And then that's never left. And I would call it slightly voyeuristic, actually, but equally, you know,
maybe don't call it voyeuristic, but we get <what you mean. laughs>
but it is, you know, watching people do their job.
Yeah. Well, LinkedIn jobs, just quickly then, just if we can move on to work, you and I are involved in a number of different things during COVID and looking at mental health impacts. But I know in particular, you looked at the impact on healthcare workers during COVID. So can you tell us so obviously we know for many it had huge impacts. Because you were involved in was it a longitudinal study?
Yeah, we are. Yeah. So what happened was I'd been on SAGE before. When you weren't even allowed to say it existed, let alone talk about it or go on news sites to discuss it. But what happened at the start of COVID was I'd set up a thing called the Health Protection Research Unit, which is funded by Public Health England and NHR. And that was looking at emergency psychological aspects of emergency responses. And obviously then we got refunded for 5 years on January the 1st, 2020. And on January the 2nd, 2020, 5 years of research was torn to pieces and we had to start all over again with COVID. And my deputy, James Rubin, who now runs the place, was immediately sucked into COVID and disappeared for 3 years, along with three others as well. So, but we stayed in touch, obviously, but we didn't see much of it. We set up what was based on the military experiences, which was to set up a new occupational cohort of healthcare workers using the same principles. And that's also still ongoing. I guess from that, the on the back of, you know, working with someone like Neil Greenberg, for example, who I'm sure you know, who's an ex-Marine for 25
years. He's Kings as well, isn't he?
He's also Kings, yes. Yeah. And he came and joined us in uniform for 10 years and then stayed, you know, after he'd done his 25 years with the Marines. And he has a particular interest in organisation. It's not just the military, but, you know, that's where it all started. And the NHS has quite a few parallels with the military. You know, it's quite a closed society in certain respects. Its members are expected to do stressful things. You know, most people go into it because, you know, it's not boring. They like, particularly, you know, if they're in A&E or things like that, they like action. You know, that's what they're doing. They're not like me and you. They like running around. And then, of course, they got it, you know, more than they expected during COVID. And there's also suspicion of outsiders. And one of the principles we'd learned from the armed forces was that when you have been exposed to adversity, we were one of the many, many people who showed. Do you remember all the psychological debriefing and all that stuff? There's, you know, immediate trauma counseling that it didn't work and probably did more harm than good. And similar with the NHS, we showed that what people actually wanted when they're in a crisis, and they were, is they wanted someone they already knew, who knew them and who would know them afterwards. And what they didn't like is people who, in the military terms, didn't wear the uniform, or in our terms, had the wrong badge. You know, if your pass wouldn't let you into wherever you are, they weren't going to pay much attention to you. And all the money we spend on external assistance programs, I mean, I think it's there more for medical legal purpose than anything else, but people don't really go. And we showed that. And what they went to was the homegrown initiatives in their own, you know, unit, trust, whatever you have. And the main thing about the other stuff was, if people don't go to see you, then whatever you're doing doesn't work. You don't need to do a trial. But we did do some trials as well. But yeah, it was an organization under strain. And the other thing is that nothing was actually new. So there was a trend for increasing mental ill health in the workforce. That started before COVID, just like it did in the population. COVID made everything worse, but it didn't create something new.
It accelerated it, really, didn't it?
Yeah. Well, it certainly it didn't. Yeah, the existing trends continued. I think the only thing that was genuinely new was the unexpected increase in eating disorders, which is still going on. And that was very much unpredicted. Mm-hmm. And we're still doing that as well, but we're still seeing the effects of that.
And what do you think on the eating disorders, Simon? What's your sense on why we have seen that increase? Because, as you know, that did start before COVID.
Well, the increase didn't. I mean, the increase that the population increase was, you know, we talk about the mental health crisis all the time, but actually it was a very specific thing. The only real change we'd ever seen in, you know, all the tens of years of psych epidemiology, most things have remained stable, except when we changed the criteria like we did with autism. But it was in children and young people, and it was predominantly young women, 16 to 24, where there was a true increase in, in anxiety, depression, and deliberate self-harm. Deliberate self-harm is not a diagnosis, but it doesn't matter. But that was the only increase, and that was what continued. And but it had been going on before COVID, but COVID certainly didn't help. And again, the paradox, which is fascinating, is, of course, the people who were getting the main mental health burden were the people who were pretty much not bothered by COVID, which has always been the paradox of the whole thing. And what would we do differently next time? Let's hope that the COVID inquiry, now past 100 million, isn't it? I do hope that it actually will come up with, I mean, it's great fun listening to who swore at who, but what we actually want is what should we do differently next time? Mm-hmm. And for me, I would think the one thing we wouldn't do is close the schools.
I'd like to think there's universal agreement on that.
There's never universal on anything.
As close as you can get to in COVID.
I'm not blaming them for doing that. And making that was a going along was true, but that is the one bit I think next time we should not do.
Again, trying to move on to cover a lot of ground here.
Keep going, Rory. You're doing very well.
So moving on. So the next bits are, I suppose, unrelated. And in this sort of conversation, you've been highlighting the importance of organizations and how they run. And obviously, organizations change all of our lives. So big one for me, before we get on to your role in the NHS, was, again, this was before COVID, I think, the Mental Health Act reform work, and you led that.
Mm.
Can you tell us a bit about that process and what impact it's had since? Because obviously, it was interrupted in some ways during COVID.
Yeah, it was. I don't think COVID had much to do with it, but yeah. I mean, what happened there was, so I'd finished as Royal College, and then I was approached to take on this independent review. And you know the way it works, that we need to review mental health legislation about, on average, about every 20 years, 25 years, because things change. Okay, it's a social construction, the Mental Health Act. It's about a balance between the desire to preserve autonomy, on the other hand, to look after the vulnerable. And that's always two mutually opposing things. And getting that balance right changes as society changes, evidence changes, people change, all sorts of things. The last one, which was, when was it? It had been about 20 years ago, had been very controversial, and it had fallen apart because of, on the one hand, the desire to push greater rights for those with mental illness, but on the other hand, the government's very strongly stated desire to have increased restrictions because of a series of highly well-publicized, terrible cases of murder by people with mental illness. And it really was an unsatisfactory compromise. what happened then was Theresa May, who people may remember, one thing she had noticed as Home Secretary was the police would always take her to see people in custody in cells who were clearly very ill. And the police do that for a reason, because they don't like that. And they wanted to show the Home Secretary, you know, do something. And she remembered that. And so the initiative actually came from her. Despite her authoritarian tendencies that we all know about and et cetera, she did want to do something in this sphere. And then the normal way is then to set up an independent inquiry. And then in the great way of British politics, I was asked to do it, not because I knew anything about it, but because I knew nothing about it.
Yeah.
And they do this enormous due diligence on you. They check every single tweet. Some poor person had to go back and look over every tweet. Not as bad as my wife, by the way, but nevertheless, I do tweet. and they found that, nope, I never, ever made a speech, never tweeted about it. They didn't look at my CV too closely because, you know, 20 years ago, I had written one paper, which they missed. They discovered that I'd also been very active for Remain. That was a problem, but they were talked out of that. Jeremy Hunt said, look, that actually was our policy. So that was okay. Yeah. And so I started off I'd learned quite a lot over the years, and I'd learned about what happens if you don't really push from day one engagement, you know, PPI, whatever you wish to call it. So we started with that. It was something I wished I'd done 30 years ago when I got involved in the world of ME. But in those days, you didn't do that kind of stuff, but now you do. So we did that, got a really good group of people together, fantastic civil servants. I was promised 20. Brexit knocked off 10. So I had 10, all of whom were incredibly young by my standards and were incredibly brilliant and were totally committed to all this.
And was this, their one job?
Pretty much.
Full-time staff?
Pretty much, yes. Yeah. A little bit of other stuff as well. But I mean, Mental Health Act reform is very complicated.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And to get, and remember the amount of stakeholders are enormous. And then I had to do the politics because they can't do that. So keeping the parties involved, et cetera, you have to do that. And then also talking to the professions, law profession, police, psychiatry, obviously the major charities, but most of all the stakeholders from the people of Afro-Caribbean heritage, which was the big issue because they were being clearly discriminated. And there's no 10 times more likely to be on a CTO. I mean, you know, we know that mental illness is slightly commoner in that group 10 times. No. So that was a big effort. And then I also spoke to other people who had done big independent reviews on how do you succeed? Because, you know, the fear is you end up on the shelf. And most reports, that's what happens. And Angelini, who's just done the report on that ghastly policeman, she was the world authority on landing reports, so she gave me a tutorial on what you do and the key things, you know, to make sure that you get something accepted on day one, and that's what separates the sheep from the goats. And so we did get the government to agree that they were and the opposition that they were going to agree to some big changes on day one, which they did, and this was on greater autonomy and more acceptance that of choice that you can be detained under the Act, but you can still have more choice about how you're treated, or even though you're detained. And we'd fallen behind other jurisdictions in Scotland, for example, on the human rights of people with mental disorder. So it was a liberalisation, but many people said we didn't go far enough. Fair enough. And some people said we went too far, which is fair enough. So you've got to plough a middle course. And I think we ended up with a pretty good job and nearly everything was accepted. It's gone a long way. It's gone through what we call, it's got a white paper. It's gone through pre-leg scrutiny. So that's very important. And was ready to go to the final stage when it got dropped by this government. Not because of any opposition, but because they only had one keen speech left and they decided that there weren't much votes in mental health reform.
But that's hugely disappointing when they moved to the mission.
I mean, it is disappointing, I agree. In the end, it's politics. Mm. And in the end, that's what they decided. Now, it will happen. Labour have committed to it. Mm-hmm. And indeed, I'm not sure that it's going to be relevant, but so have the Conservatives as well, mm-hmm. That it will be in the next King's speech, the first King's speech of the next Parliament.
So you have a confirmation from the Labour Party that yes. will be in?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Publicly, yeah, both yeah. privately and publicly. Mm-hmm. And we're at the stage now where, you know, now switching back to NHS England, we are now talking to Labour about, you know, what do they really want to do? And this mm-hmm. is an accepted procedure. You don't, you know, let's assume that the pollsters are all correct and they become the next government. You don't want them to turn up with a hangover on day one and then tell you what they want. They've yeah. got to tell you now. yeah. And that is one of the things, yeah.
Oh, that's yeah. really hopeful because I mean, I was yeah. so disappointed whenever
yes, I think we all were. I mean,
thing was announced.
To be fair, they didn't yeah. say we've decided it's all wrong. You know, fairly openly actually. That look, you know, we've only got a certain amount of time left, yeah. and the PM doesn't think there's any votes in this, and prefers you know. Other legislation that you know to change the course of the government, but it will go in the manifesto mm-hmm. and it will be back. I said, well, that will lose us 2-3 years. And say, yeah, I know, but sorry, yeah. that's you know, that's finally what well, it's what governments can do. Mm-hmm. But you know, a serious government has to do stuff like this that isn't very popular,
yeah,
but it's what a serious government does, and mm-hmm. so it will happen,
yeah. Well, fingers crossed that's yeah. the case, but. That set us up nicely, really, for the last sort of substantive bit of our conversation, Simon. And it's your current role then, last year, whatever you took over, or you became a board member for the
NHS. Yes.
So how's that been and what reflections?
It's it's a bit weird. I mean, it's a bit weird because, I mean, the NHS, the budget is something like £180 billion. I mean, it's astronomical. Mm-hmm. And yet we're completely broke. yeah. And everyone, you know, you start off thinking, well, now we can really do something. And actually, the room for manoeuvre is tiny. It really is very little because everything is committed, overcommitted. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, and then there are things that you can't, you know, the industrial action costing us eye-watering sums, but we have no control over it. That's the DH. And so all these things come along and everything, you know, we need, with things we need, new IT, the cost of new drugs, enormous, all of these things that we haven't got budgets for. So mm-hmm. much of the time, you're actually reacting to events. So Lucy Letby, the nurse from Chester, yeah. took up a lot of time. You would say, well, that shouldn't really be a board issue, but it is because it's a reputational issue and everyone's very concerned. So it's frustrating.
But is it like, but it's more meant to be strategic rather
than yes, it
than
is, but it's often day-to-day. Not. I mean, yeah. it's often quite operational.
Yeah.
And I know everyone goes around saying, you know, oh, it's bureaucracy gone mad, red tape gone mad, far too many administrate the NHS. We actually have far too few. Mm-hmm. We have the percentage we spend on administration, it's something like 3-4% of this enormous budget. No company would yeah. do that. So again, it's so easy to say, oh, let's get rid of the bureaucrats and put people in frontline care. But if you don't have the back office function, it just makes life even more stressful. Mm-hmm. So you know, you've got to be serious about that. And you know, that there is a genuine belief that we need to invest more in prevention. Mm-hmm. There is a genuine belief that we don't have the balance between primary and secondary care. We have 82% of all work is done in primary care and they get 8% of the budget. So 82% of work. Wow. And then, you know, people watching this are going to say, well, you can't see your GP anymore. Last week, 10% of the entire population saw their GP, 10%. And that's more than before COVID. And yet, you know, but because demand has gone up so much since COVID, we're not coping.
Well, so just to make sure I get those figures correct, what you just said. Mm-hmm. So 82% mm-hmm. of all the work in the NHS
yep.
is through primary care.
Yes.
And they get 8% of the budget.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah, they're wow. incredibly efficient. But the problem they've got is obviously they have a workforce problem as well. Mm-hmm. And indeed, probably the most important thing we do on the board is the workforce plan, the 10-year plan. Mm-hmm. Because if you get the workforce right, much of the rest will sort itself out. Mm-hmm. But there is a real desire to change that. But it's incredibly difficult. And it'll need political political say-so, a change, of a real shift of resource into the community can only be done by.
Well, so that was my, could be my next point, which is, being devil's advocate here, do you actually have any power? Because if the political party of the day doesn't agree with what you want, you won't have.
Oh, well, that's fairly clear. I mean, you know, the NHS reforms, which have been, you know, slowly rode back on because they weren't very helpful. The idea was, they, you know, to put the NHS above politics, make it independent of politics. That's absolute nonsense. Mm-hmm. You know, it is the largest item in government. It's taxpayers. I mean, I'm going to sound like some terrible Tory now, but I'm not. But it's 180 billion of taxpayers' money. Of course it's political. I mean, how can it not be? And it should be political. I don't have any objection to that. I would just like it to be sensible politics and also long-term politics. And I feel very sorry for, I've always felt sorry for politicians, and I've always quite liked them, actually, because I think on the whole, they're pretty honest people. They work really hard and they do the best they can. There are exceptions, but they generally do. But this is really difficult. And but I can't remember what I was talking about now to start that sentence, but that is difficult because they end up being short-term. Because people's memories are short term, particularly when they come to election. And we spend lots of time on very short term things. Well, what we want is them to think about, you know, the real challenges we face: demographics, workforce, aging population, cost of drugs, increasing demand, which really should concern people watching this podcast, because that is a big problem now. We are overheating the mental health services. What can we do about that?
Well, let's focus on mental health services for a second then, which are overstretched under resourced and so on. So again, what's your insider's view? What have you any take-home messages on what we should be doing differently or could do differently?
Yes. I mean, I think one area I think we should acknowledge success, which is everything right from when we started this podcast, talking about how popular attitudes have changed towards mental disorder. The younger generation now, I can't think of whatever generation is, but the new generations absolutely get mental health in a way that my generation and yours didn't. And the way they talk, you know, is completely different. But it doesn't come without a cost. And, you know, we've been pushing mental health awareness now since, you know, we were in nappies almost. And now, of course, the truth is most people who have mental disorders are aware that they do. And that isn't the reason that they're not seeking help. They're not seeking help because either they feel like the military often do, they can manage it themselves, but more often something about stigma. But a lot of it is because they don't particularly like our services. They're not entirely wrong on that. And the waiting lists are too long. Well, they're definitely right on that. And so it's not about awareness anymore. And the downside of awareness is what we're seeing in a younger generation is, and I know this from, I went and spoke in 40 medical schools. I thought there were 20. There are 40. I went to every one. God knows how many colleges as well. And, you know, if you look at the data, about 70 to 75% of the 16 to 24-year-olds, i.e. university students and non-university students, say they have poor mental health or they have mental health problems or some form of language to indicate that. But they're not just referring to the depression and anxiety, deliberate self-harm, eating disorders that we started off with. They're now also referring to things like loneliness and homesickness and exam stress and all these things, which you and I, it's not that we wouldn't think of them as mental health problems, but we wouldn't think that me and you have the solutions to that. These don't respond to antidepressants. They're probably not respond to counseling or CBT. They're about loneliness. You would promote social networks, you know, that's to that. And in other words, the solutions are not professional. And I think we've got to really start accepting that now, that the way there is to, you know, in a university setting you and I work in, is to push, let's put more into sports, more into culture, more into opera, more into volunteering, join political parties, anything that improves your social network. And none of that involves me and you.
Yeah, but no, I think that's a great point. I think it's not an either or, of course. It's that mixed approach. But I think my concern over the last decade and a half has been actually those are the things that have been cut, right? So
they have.
Community organizations, funding for early intervention, for example, with parents and new parents and lots of where you've networks to support people when they're going through this really difficult new situation. That's what we need to be investing in, as well as, of course, thinking. I like your idea about we need to redesign our mental health services as well, and ask the people who are most vulnerable what's the best form that those services could take, and then get the evidence.
But this isn't even about mental health services. It's like that word social prescribing. I know what it means, but I wish it wasn't called prescribing, because that already brings up an image that I don't want people to have of a doctor with their prescription pad. You know, and the evidence base for much of this is very strong. Mm-hmm. You know, you look at Daisy Fancourt at UCL and all that stuff, it's very strong, but that's the evidence, but it doesn't need us. And I'm more worried about, look what's happening, like ADHD, 600% increase in a short period of time. Now, that is not an increase in prevalence. I mean, that is not an increase in prevalence. That's impossible. But it is overheating the system.
Yeah.
And probably leading to, people getting, being treated for something that they don't need.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But the point on the wider issue, it struck me that before COVID, each nation of the UK had a minister responsible for loneliness, right? And I'm firmly behind that. Right?
You're right, yes.
Really important, because if you read the documentation behind it, a lot of it was looking at promoting social connections, tackling inequalities and all those sorts of issues, which are really, really important. But I've heard very little about loneliness.
That's a very good point. And of course, loneliness isn't a mental disorder. It can cause mental disorders, but of course, it's not. Yeah. Yes, that's a good point, Rory, and good. And I imagine a minister for loneliness would be doing some of those things that we've just been talking about, and wouldn't need to talk to me and you to do that.
Well, it's not that you don't need to. It's looking beyond. It's like the different multi-level response, of course. But okay, Simon, right? Time is against us here, right? So, is there anything else just on terms of your key messages? Are you optimistic? So I'm hoping you say something positive here, right? Are you optimistic after your time and your time currently sitting on the NHS board?
Yeah, yes. I mean, I'm optimistic in three ways. The first thing is this, that I do believe that, what we do is it's time for we're going to get the big break in the way that, neurology did 100 years ago, mm-hmm. cardiology did 60 years ago, immunology did 30 years ago, that there will be some basic science coming out of the money we're putting into neuroscience that will help us in the major mental disorders. I do believe that. I have no idea where it's going to come from, but I think particularly in the dementias, schizophrenia, bipolar, we're due for a break. And I think we will get that. That's the first thing. The second thing is we can't put the clock back in terms of a new generation taking mental health more seriously. That's great. As I say, I want to kind of shape it a bit more so it's not, and that we recognize that there are drawbacks as well as good things. That's true. I think it's great now that people do want to work in the mental health field in a way that they didn't before. That's good. Obviously, some of the policies that we've had in the last few years have not helped workforce. Yeah. You and I know what I'm talking about, and the audience know what I'm talking about. But even that will, I think, ease off as time goes by. So yeah, no, I am optimistic. Mm-hmm. I'm pessimistic. I'm worried about the future of the universities, that neither mm-hmm. political party seems to appreciate the financial crisis there. I am worried about where is a new workforce going to come from, particularly in social care, because, without that, things will happen. I think those would be the big things. But fundamentally, I do think psychiatry, psychology is an incredibly good career for graduates. Mm-hmm. I've absolutely loved it. I know you have too. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't do anything else. It's been very good to me, and I hope I've given something back in the later years. So,
And still are giving back, Simon. It's not over yet.
No, that's true. Yeah.
So Simon, here, just to finish with two last things.
Okay.
But I'm just curious, because if we can rewind, we've been looking forward there. But, and I know obviously that your family history and your father, I think, came over in the kinder transport.
Yes.
And I remember when I saw This Is Your Life, you can see you, I think, in the audience when that was announced, and obviously. So can you tell us about that story, a bit about that? Okay. And then recently, was it the last couple of years, it was One Life, was that the movie?
Yes, One Life, came out just last year. Yes, I mean, my father was one of the so-called Winton children from Nicholas Winton, who rescued 663 children from what would, without any question, been certain death if they stayed behind in Czechoslovakia. And yes, and obviously his life had a big influence on me, and how that story developed had a big influence on him. I am in that Esther Ransom program.
Yeah.
Everyone talks about when, every time I say this, I tear up. It's ridiculous. But when she says, you know, if anyone here owes their life to Nicholas Winton, could they stand up? You see, I'm doing it again. And I stand up. I did hope in the film, my part, which is, as you said, right in the far right corner, was going to be played by Tom Cruise. But he was busy. And it was a transforming moment that, you know, I've never forgotten. And from that, you know, I get some of my politics comes from that, and still does. But I also remember the fact that my father wouldn't be here, and therefore I wouldn't be here without A, somebody doing good, not just Nicholas Winton, but the Anglican family that took my father in and then would become my foster grandparents when I grew up, who had to pay, what was it, the equivalent now of several thousand pounds in order to host a Jewish boy. So good people and this country, because I mean, we didn't do anything like enough, but if we hadn't had a tolerant attitude towards it, then by this time it was just child refugees, but not adults, again, wouldn't be here. So that's affected me, sure. And it's important part of my life.
Powerful story, yeah.
It is, yes. I mean, you know, in the end, did it make much difference? Not really, against the sheer scale and horror of the Holocaust, but it certainly made a difference to me.
But I think what it highlights is every one of us can make a difference.
Yes, it does do that. It's
that's
a perfect
example. I really take from it. And if, and if you add all the one of us together, we can change the world. And I know that sounds trite, but it's true.
Yeah, and another film about it's not the first film being made about Nicky Winton. It is the best. Anthony Hopkins is uncannily like him. I mean, he looks like him and talks like him. But yet one other film was called The Kindness of Strangers, which is another way of putting it. So yeah, that's had an effect on me. And my dad's dead now, but I was always very close and very proud of him. And my mum as well, who came from a working class family in Doncaster. Quite a weird family with lots of pretty dark secrets, actually. But she escaped that by being very good at music. And she was one of the founding members of the National Youth Orchestra. And for her, music was got her away from a very oppressive and difficult background. So, you know, it's going back to Mike Rutter. You're good at one thing, then you can escape very, you know, pretty difficult circumstances.
Well, no, thanks, Simon, for sharing that. I think it is such a powerful imagery, I think, it evokes as well, and especially given the difficult times we're living through at the minute. So, Simon, our last thing, just to bring the podcast to an end, is we've two quick fire questions.
All right.
Right. So the first one is, and again, it's us being reflective again.
Yeah.
So what advice would you give your 16-year-old self?
Okay. I wouldn't give advice. I've learned never to give advice, and that because I've been given so much terrible advice. I think terrible advice is actually much better than good advice. So I would not say, you know, you've got to be in the right place at the right time. I wouldn't say anything. I'd just probably say, good luck, Simon, which is what my parents said to me, actually. Mm. They didn't think I was doing the right thing. They just said, well, good luck. That would be that. Yeah.
I don't think everybody's answered. No, we've never had this one. Like, But I suppose
we wouldn't listen anyway. It's the whole point about being a teenager is you don't listen to advice, do you?
I suppose you're being empowering. Your answer is empowering. Believe in yourself.
Oh, God, don't say empowering. Oh, no.
Oh, no, is this another like holistic? You don't like that?
Yes, it is. Absolutely.
Okay, Simon, the last question, then we'll bring it to a close, is think about somebody you would love to have dinner or coffee with, who, living or dead, famous or not famous, but you would really benefit or would love to have that conversation.
I was thinking of that as we're talking, because I didn't know you told me at the start, but I was literally trying to think whilst I was talking. But I would like to organise a dinner of Simons. Because Simon now is a name that's gone completely out of fashion. It's not even the top 1,000. But there are some bloody wonderful Simons around. My hobby is reading history. I'm obsessed with it. And so I would like to have three historians. And there'd be Simon Sharma, who I had the privilege of interviewing, Simon Sebag Montefiore, who I had the privilege of interviewing, and then Simon Stevens, who actually is a historian. And I would have a dinner of four Simons, and we'd talk history all night and drink red wine. And that's what I would like to do.
Excellent. And it's, hold on, Simon Stevens, that's NHS.
That's right, NHS. But he read history at Oxford,
Okay, excellent. Well, we've never had, that's two firsts. We got, and going for the Collection. What's a collection of Simons called?
Oh, an annoyance, I think, or possibly a wisdom. I don't know. Not sure. A wisdom of Simons.
Anyway, Simon, obviously, this Simon, you.
Thank you.
No, Simon Wesley, thanks so much for taking the time. It was a great journey to be on. And again, on behalf of psychologists, psychiatrists, and all the rest of us in mental health science, thanks for everything you have done. We'll continue to do, not just in doing great science and practice, but that communication element you also really excel at. So thanks so much. And hopefully everybody enjoys it.
And thanks to you, Rory, and thanks to MQ.
MQ Open Mind is presented by MQ Mental Health Research, the only organisation that exclusively invests into scientific research around mental health. Our vision is to create a world where mental illnesses are understood, effectively treated, and one day prevented. Please leave us a review and let us know what you think about the podcast. Each review helps us reach a wider audience. Visit mqmentalhealth.org to learn more about MQ and mental health research.